Welcome to Narcisse Bible Study. This, what is it, April 21st, 2018. Welcome to a lot of you who I haven't seen before. And in fact, I'm pleasantly surprised to have with us. It's a pleasure to be here this Shabbat morning. We have been working through, in this little Bible study, the parasha from Jesus' day. So for those who don't know what parasha is, it is a section of Torah, the first five books, and it's a reading schedule. So today, all around the Jewish world, they read the same portion of texts from the first five books of the Bible. Each of those portions are then matched with a portion from the prophets. And if you think about it, it's like having a dinner. You have a main course, and then you have a dessert. And if you go to a nice restaurant, the chef has to think, what dessert goes with this meal? If you make chicken pot pie, you don't want to serve pie for dessert. You want complementary things. So, the parasha we read today goes back maybe 1,000-something years. But they have some discoveries of an older parasha that was slower. So today, we start Simchat Torah every fall, and you read through the whole first five books in 1 year. But in Jesus' day, they read through those five books in maybe 3 to 4 years. It was imprecise. They didn't end exactly at the same time every year because they didn't make it through in 1 year. And so there are some who have tried to find these old sections, and we have been following the old sections as disciples of Jesus because it's fascinating to see what he and his disciples would have been talking about. So in the end, if you have shorter sections of the first five books, the topics you cover will naturally connect to a different topic in the prophets. So, indeed, today you find that there is no Isaiah 53 in the Haftarah, in the prophetic literature, in their yearly cycle. But in this 3-year cycle, they do have Isaiah 53, they have Isaiah 55, and they have some other kind of messianic texts. And so for us, it has been a great thing to follow through and see some of these connections between Torah and prophets, the Torah and the Haftarah. So today's sections, I'm sorry I don't have a board down here. Let me pull up my thing. We are in the book of Numbers, chapter 5, verses 11 to 31. And this selection is particularly strange. It has been paired by whichever chef in those days did to Hosea 4, verses 14 and following. And I have to say a word before we read these texts. One of the ways in Jewish reading that you interpret texts is to put them together. And in fact, in the Bible, when two texts come together, the one text interprets the other. And there are many examples of this. We call it smichut parashiot, when you take two sections and put them together. And so it's fascinating, just in these texts we're going to read, It's like the person who chose to put them together is making a statement by doing so. And when you read them together, you get that message, I think. So, our normal pattern is that we go just in a circle, or in this case, row to row. Whoever has the text in front of them reads 3 verses, 4, whatever works, and the next person continues to read until we go through all the verses. So, and you can be following, or whoever is following. Yes.
Thank you.
So we're in Numbers 5, verse 11. And if you don't have English, you just tap the person next to you and they'll carry on reading. So, Amos, do you have English there?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you can start us, and then we'll carry on this way and kind of snake like that.
The Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the Israelites, and tell them, if any man's wife goes astray and behaves unfaithfully towards him, and the man has sexual relations with her without her husband knowing it, and it is hidden that she has defiled herself, since there was no witness against her, nor was she cognizant?
Caught.
And if jealously feelings come over him and he became suspicious of his wife when she is defiled, or if jealous feeling come over him and he became suspicious of his wife when she is not defiled, then the man must bring his wife to the priest, and he must bring the offering required for her on 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He must not pour olive oil on it, or pour frankincense on it.
Could you identify? And the priest shall bring her near.
Hold on, which, Gemma, could you say what verse you're starting
next? 16, Numbers 5, starting at 16.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm done?
Yes.
And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. The priest shall take the holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. Then the priest shall stand the woman before the Lord, uncover the woman's head, and put the offering for remembering in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And the priest shall have it in his hands, the bitter water that brings a curse. And the priest shall put her under oath and say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you've not gone astray to uncleanliness while under your husband's authority, be free from this bitter water that brings a curse. But if you've gone astray while under your husband's authority, and if you've defiled yourself and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then the priest shall put the woman under the oath of the curse, and he shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people, when the Lord makes your thigh rot and your belly swell, and may this water that causes the curse go into your stomach, and make your belly swell and your thigh rot. Then the woman shall say, amen, so be it.
The priest is to write these curses on a scroll and then wash them off into the bitter water. He shall have the woman drink bitter water that brings a curse, and this water will enter her and cause bitter suffering. The priest is to take from her hands the grain offering for jealousy, wave it before the Lord, and bring it to the altar. The priest is then to take a handful of the grain offering as a memorial offering and burn it on the altar. After that, he is to have the woman drink the water. If she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, then when she is made to drink the water that brings the curse, it will go into her and cause bitter suffering. Her abdomen will swell and her thigh waste away, and she will become accursed among her people. If, however, the woman has not defiled herself and is free from impurity, she will be cleared of guilt and will be able to have children.
This is the law for jealousy. When either a wife, under her husband's authority, goes astray and becomes unclean, or the spirit of jealousy comes over a husband and he becomes jealous of his wife, then he is to place the woman before Adonai, and the Kohen is to deal with her in accordance with all of this law. The husband will be clear of guilt, but the wife will bear the consequences of her guilt.
Okay. So, before we read the prophetic segment that matches this, I'll just say this is a strange selection. For many reasons. One, it seems random. We don't have a parallel rule for husbands who go astray. And if you've been reading through Numbers, why does this come here? We haven't had a whole list of laws in general like we've worked through in Leviticus. So what's it doing? And for that answer, I would point you to the words used in the beginning of this section. If a wife goes astray, and it says, and acts unfaithfully. This same word is found in the selection before. Let's see, where can I find it now? Lim'ol ma'al, to act unfaithfully, or like it's a breach of covenant. And it's one of the words used of Israel against God. And so maybe this ruling was put here because of that verbal connection. And really, maybe it is metaphorical for, or could be seen as a metaphor for Israel, since the country is pictured as female and she's in a relationship with God, her husband. So it's interesting how it ended up here. Many things about this ritual are shocking. And actually, if you study the ancient Near East, you can see some parallels. And the reason I think that's important is because when you compare it to its peers, what other people were doing at the time, the differences snap out. And it's those differences that are the important part. So even today, other religions have similar, what's a tekes?
Ceremony.
They have similar ceremonies that have some element that appears to be a little magical, meaning that there's an element that actually has a property of power. Most of the rest of the Bible doesn't have this kind of thing, like water that can come into you and curse you. This is something very foreign to the Bible. However, that's why I want to point out some differences. In the ancient Near East, when you would have a similar type of ceremony, the element you're using is not neutral. They might actually give you a type of poison that in 2 out of 3 cases will kill you, and in 1 case you'll survive. So it's true, you don't know if you're going to survive or die, but there's actually, it's the cup is half empty. Where in this case, it's just water. There is no poison in there. It's water with some dirt from the tabernacle and the ink of the words of this oath that has been washed off into the water. So it's really like a nice metaphor, but what you have in the water won't actually hurt you on a natural level one way or another. So that is a huge difference between the Bible and other cultures. There's actually nothing magic in the water. It is simply symbolic, and then it's the power of God that has to act. So that's a big difference. The other thing rabbis will point out is it mentions first, if the woman is innocent, nothing will happen to her. So it starts off with the benefit of the doubt. She's innocent, fine, no big deal. Why do this ceremony at all? Is a big question. And I think, besides obviously the problem of adultery, you don't always get caught, right? But I think it's actually to solve the problem that you could have in a marriage if someone is continually jealous. How do you bring an end to this and move on? And so if the husband is jealous, he can. There's actually a way to go to the priest, do this, and if all is well, he has to stop being jealous, basically. And he has to move on. And so it actually can be seen as a way to reinstate a good relationship where something has been wrong. And help an innocent woman who maybe her husband is just a jealous kind of person. And instead of living with constant condemnation or suspicion, it allows a full stop. No, we're going to move past this, and everything is level playing ground again. We start fresh. What other elements are in here? Obviously, taking down your hair. In other contexts in Leviticus, we've read it's an act of mourning. Well, that's one of the understandings of it. And like when it says Aaron and his sons, when they're in a holy condition, they're not allowed to mourn their fathers and mothers. They're not allowed to make their hair messy and all these other things associated with mourning. And so in this ceremony, it's a very solemn thing. Also, what is the flower she's bringing? Did you notice the flower she's bringing?
Barley.
What is it?
Barley.
So what do you think about barley? What does it tell you?
Passover.
Sorry?
Passover.
Oh, you're thinking times of the year? Mm-hmm. It is before wheat for harvest time. But who eats barley? Animals and the poor, exactly. It's considered less. Many offerings are solet, which is a fine flour made out of wheat. This offering is barley. So it's a very solemn kind of basic. There's nothing happy about this offering. It's just very solemn. There's no oil added, and there's no frankincense, which are also the symbols of like a happy, joyful offering. So that's not part of it. And yes, animals can eat barley because it's the second class grain. Except for me, I love barley. I don't eat wheat. The other thing about this selection, the consequences of this whole ceremony, if she is guilty, it seems to be connected to childbirth. Often in the Bible, they use the word thigh as a euphemism. So Jacob, it says, it describes Jacob's descendants as those who came out of his thigh. So descendants don't come out of your thigh. But it is in the right region. And that's what we call a euphemism. And so here, people suspect that to have a fallen thigh is euphemistic, possibly as a metaphor for becoming infertile. And as you see, if she's innocent, she actually, it says that she will be able to have children. So if you're innocent, you will be able to have children. Then presumably, if you're not innocent, you won't be able to have children. So that could be what a fallen thigh, that's what it says literally, that could be what it means. And possibly also swollen stomach. There are two metaphors. Alternatively, it could be some type of disease. But it does seem from the context that in either case, the result is infertility.
But you couldn't follow on with Jacob's side. The fact that he lived for the rest of his life.
No, that's another word.
That's another one.
I'm talking about Yerech. Yerech.
Oh, right.
And there are other examples too. All languages do this. Also in the laws in Leviticus, there are several euphemisms. One is thigh, one is flesh, is basar. And in the context, you understand that it's not his arm, its particular area of his flesh. But we all need euphemisms in life, so we create them. All languages do it. And then when you translate, your translation has to also probably be euphemistic with some type of footnote so you understand what you're talking about.
Bottom is a euphemism.
Yeah, I suppose.
It just means down.
Bottom means down or rear.
Yeah.
And different dialects will consider the different euphemisms okay. Like, this euphemism is okay, this is vulgar, we don't say that. You know? Like, I know some dialects of English or some people are opposed to using the word but, as in B-U-T-T, as we don't say that, we need to say rear, or, I don't know, hiney. There's many euphemisms. And other people consider that standard basic communication, and maybe you wouldn't use another word.
Are there euphemisms in sign language for that?
So I'm saying, you know, I'd have to explain them to show it to you, but yeah, there are. Not for that one particularly, but you'd have to expand it. There wouldn't be one sign for it. There'd be several signs to make up the euphemism.
Yeah, okay. Is there a sign for the word euphemism?
No, I don't know. I just asked John, what's the sign for euphemism? One, so I'm going to use that.
Okay. Yeah, once you've established that, then you can keep going.
Do you think that the mention of childbearing here actually gives a clue for another possible reason apart from husband jealousy? Mm. It's to prove paternity, or at least to clear out of the way doubt about paternity.
Yeah, it could be. There are interpreters who have said, well, maybe the woman is pregnant, and the husband, for some reason, doubts that it's his. That could be. And in that case, this whole ritual would then lead to an abortion, a natural abortion. What do we call it? Miscarriage. It's a possible reading. Right. But clearly, there is a breach of their relationship that's at the core of the issue. Or there wouldn't be this jealousy. And so that's what needs to be resolved. All right. So after this, albeit strange, selection, we will read the corresponding prophetic section. Now, Hosea, you remember, is a bit of a strange prophet. His ministry was in northern Israel at a time when many people in Israel were not worshiping God in the way he had laid out. They were under Jeroboam's influence. They were not coming to the temple in Jerusalem. They had high places in the north. Most of the pagan religions around them worshiped their gods with temple prostitution. To guarantee fertility, you go to the high place and you sleep with a temple prostitute. And this is how you secure good crops for the new year. Fertility, like children. Children in the Bible days are your workforce. So if you have no children, you're going to be poor. You're going to be begging. So these issues of survival and living and getting crops, they're all connected to fertility. And if you live in this land, it's very dependent on rain, right? We don't have huge rivers. In fact, you remember Naaman, the leader of the army, was making fun of the Jordan. What's that? It's this little stream. And if you've all been to the Jordan, you see today, it's not such a big river, right? So Israel is very dependent on rain, and God has always told them that. And he has promised them, I will send the rain if you follow my covenant. So there's that whole interesting dependence on God by necessity because of the land you're living in. So in Hosea's day, he's talking to Israel, trying to call them back to knowing God, the true God, and not going after Baal. But there's actually two problems. There's going after Baal, and there's also worshiping God in the wrong way. And both of those are idolatry. And so, what did Hosea do? Who remembers? He married a prostitute of, yeah, at least one. There's some prostitute.
Yeah.
Or he married a woman who was unfaithful. They could be different. They could be the same thing. Or the one could lead to the other. If you look at the words used, it's a little bit confusing. But in either case, that relationship with his wife was meant to be a picture of Israel's relationship with God. And so, in that sense, I think Hosea would be the perfect place to turn to after just reading this strange little portion of Numbers. So, let's read Hosea 4, verses 14, and we'll carry on. Where did we get to? Francis? Okay, you can start us off. I think we'll just go ahead and finish, let's see, 4:14 to the end of the verse. Sorry, to the end of the chapter. Francis, you may.
So I will not punish your daughters when they turn to prostitution, nor your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery, because the men themselves consort with harlots and sacrifice with crying prostitutes. A people without understanding will come to ruin.
Go ahead and carry.
Though you Israel play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth Aven, nor swear an oath, saying, as the Lord lives. For Israel is stubborn, like a stubborn calf. Now the Lord will let them forage like a lamb in open country.
Ephraim has joined the idols, leave him alone. When their drink is gone, they give themselves to whoring. Their rulers dearly love shame.
A wind has wrapped them in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices.
Okay. So it's not clear to me, when the ancients put these texts together, how far they kept reading, because usually you quote the first verse and then you continue for the whole section. We have a small section break here, the stuma. And the question is, would they have kept reading also into chapter 5 or not? And I'm not sure.
I mean, it goes on. I mean, verse 3 and 4.
We might as well go on. There is also...
You committed the idolatry. Israel is defiled.
Right,
they do
right.
Not direct their deeds towards turning to their God.
So why don't we read chapter 5 as well? We'll carry on. Where were we? Over there? Over
there? Could you just say where you're starting to read from for me? That would be helpful. Because it will locate me on the page.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think it's the beginning verse of chapter 5.
You want me to start?
Sure, yes.
Hear this, priest. Pay attention, house of Israel. Listen, royal house. The judgment applies to you because you have been a snare at Mizpah and a net spread out at table. Rebels are deeply involved in slaughter, and I will be punished. I will be a punishment for them all.
Or discipline, it says.
I know all about Israel.
That's verse 3.
Also stumbled within.
with their crops.
Okay, that's verse 6.
They shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. They have dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage.
Their fields even.
Verse 8. Blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, sound the alarm at Beth-Aven. We follow you, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment among the tribes of Israel. I'll make known what is sure. The princes of Judah have become those who move the landmark. Upon them I will pour out my wrath like water.
We're in verse 11. Who would like to read?
If
okay, well maybe. Ah, yes. In verse 15 here it says, until they become guilty, that was suffer the punishment. And that's one of the words that connects to our parasha. She will bear her guilt if she's guilty. And then, of course, we have to read, I'll just read the end positive part in Hosea 6:1, some beautiful verses. Come on, let's return to the Lord. He himself has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. And it's beautiful, even if you don't speak Hebrew, listen. It says, Hu taraf v'yirpa'enu, yach v'yach b'shenu. So the yach v'yach b'shenu. One is a weird form for hitting us, striking us, and the other is for bandaging us up. And you hear this alliteration. It's very beautiful poetry. Hosea is a beautiful poet. So beautiful that it's hard sometimes to understand his words, like all good poetry. He has injured us, but he will bandage our wounds. He will restore us in a very short time. He will heal us. In a very short time, it actually says, from 2 days. And it kind of reminds me of the law about servants or slaves, that if you beat them but don't kill them and they're able to get up after 2 days, it's okay. That thing kind of ties together. Of course, we as Christians have other associations with after 2 days living again. In our case, 3 days. But because it says on the third day, "Beyom hashlishi yakimenu v'nichye lefanav." On the third day, he will raise us up, and we will live before him. And verse 3, this is really Hosea's whole theme. So let us acknowledge him. Let us seek to acknowledge the Lord. He will come to our rescue as certainly as the appearance of the dawn, as certainly as the winter rain comes, as certainly as the spring rain that waters the land. So you have these images of rain, again, that brings the fertility, and it's God. But there's something you miss here in translation that's really important. And it's this word acknowledge. When we use the word acknowledge in English, it kind of sounds very formal and very, okay, I realize that. In Hebrew, ladat, in biblical Hebrew, this is experience of knowing. You know someone. In fact, Adam knows his wife so well, she has a child. There's actually many instances where, again, a euphemism, to know someone is to have sexual intercourse with them. And you can't get more of an intimate knowledge than that. And so, Hosea's words are much more powerful in Hebrew than in English. Because he's using metaphoric language. When he says, know the Lord, it's shocking people. Even today, you don't say, I know someone. You say, you use a different word, ani makira. You can't say ani yodat. That would imply that there's something, a physical relationship between you. So when Hosea says, know the Lord, it's a shocking metaphor. It's intimate, it's mind-blowing, and it's a perfect foil, a perfect opposite of what the people were doing to Baal. They're going to temple prostitutes, having sex with them to try to secure fertility and, you know, have security in their future. And God's saying, no, you come know me. Don't know them, know me. And so it's a very, very powerful image. And that is Hosea's whole message, really. Know the Lord, know the Lord, know the Lord. And when we hear it in English, it loses the shock value. It also maybe loses the whole connotation of just what an intimate relationship God is asking for. Now, he's obviously not asking for a physical union with you, because that's not going to happen. He's God. He's spirit, to be worshipped in spirit. But it's that intimacy that he's asking for that is amazing. But again, let's go back to the beginning of Hosea 4:14, where our selection started. And how does it start? I am not going to remember when your daughters prostitute themselves. And the verb prostitute yourself is really any sexual relationship outside marriage. So it doesn't mean that they were a temple prostitute to qualify. There were maybe two levels. On a moral level, society had gone astray. And on a worship level, they were worshiping through this temple prostitution. So two things could be going on. But the point is, God says, I am not going to hold them accountable. Why not? What's it say?
Sounds like the husbands are doing the same thing.
Yeah, because you guys are doing the same thing. And so it's an interesting answer, because when you read Numbers, one of the questions you have was, well, hey, what about the men? What if they go astray? And so by pairing this main course with the dessert, it's kind of like a reminder of, don't think any of you can get off scot-free. Everyone will be held accountable. And God's going to be fair in the way he deals with the one case and the other. And so it just immediately reminded me of the New Testament, where Jesus says, you know, don't try to take the big beam out of your brother's the speck out of your brother's eye when you have a big beam in your own eye. First deal with your big beam, pull it out, and then you'll see clearly to take out the speck from your brother. And just that whole justice, true justice. Did someone else see a connection between these passages that stood out to them or that they want to share? Yes, you have that drinking theme. And you're talking about 18, right? Yeah, and those are some strange words in Hebrew, but yes. You have images of someone drinking, and the drinking connected to this cult prostitution, or this waywardness, leaving the path. And the selection in Numbers is called Sota. Sota, today, I mean, we would call it pervert. But perverted means it's not the truth. It's not the straight way. It's not the right way. You've left it. You've gone astray.
Deviant.
You're deviant, yeah. And so,
what struck me when we first started was that the guys are getting it as well. Verse 14, but the men themselves have gone part with harlot.
Exactly.
And offer sacrifices to a ritual harlot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this really.
Well, no, they're not offering to a ritual harlot. They are with a ritual harlot sacrificing.
It says, I've got an offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot.
Yeah, with. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there may be the sexual act is some kind of symbolic thing that happens in the whole ceremony of offering your offering.
Right.
And I don't think we really have the details. We're reading through the eyes of the Bible that is just pointing to what's wrong. We don't have the texts of those pagans, so we don't have the details of what exactly they did, but we can put it together from what we see, what you're not supposed to do here. So there was some type of temple prostitution. They would also be offering offerings somewhere in those ceremonies. I don't know which came first or how it happened, but they're connected, yes.
In 18, when he talks about their drink is rebellion,
mm-hmm.
the word is not mered.
No.
Sorer.
You know the rebellious child law? What do you do if you have a son who's rebellious? This is the same word, sorer. Stubborn, not listening to you. And here Israel is compared to a cow, a stubborn cow. And God's going to pasture them like a sheep in the field. Sheep are not stubborn. They're stupid, but they're not as stubborn. I'm not an expert in animals, but I also see maybe some natural metaphors here. You've been around the country. Where do you see cows mostly? Where are cows?
In the field.
Okay, in which area of the country?
The north.
The north, yeah. Where it's distinctly greener up north, and it can satisfy the needs of cows better. And if you go to the prophet Amos, he calls the women in the north, you cows of the Bashan, which today Bashan is like Golan, it's that whole area. Because that's where you have good enough pasture for cows to feed. And sheep, well, they could be anywhere, but you see a lot of sheep around here. Where else do you see sheep?
In the desert
or down south where it's very dry, sheep can still manage to find their little bits of food. So Hosea's preaching to people in the north. Also on a socio-economical level, during Hosea's time, where are the rich people living? Who can tell me?
In cities.
In cities, yeah, but where in terms of areas of Israel, the greater Israel? In the northern kingdom. So in this kingdom that's rebelling, they've got all the rich people right now. Not all of them. I'm sure there are families in Judah, there were some rich people still. But in terms of the social economic boom, it's happening in the north. Jeroboam II had an incredible dynasty. Things were growing. And so it was a time where people may have been confused. Like, it's very easy to read blessing as, oh, God must be putting his stamp of approval. And so Hosea is pointing out the opposite, definitely. But it's interesting how that all ties together. Where you live and what metaphors you're seeing, you know, cows versus sheep, the northern kingdom as pictured by cows as the bigger animal. And in fact, cows are from the north, so it kind of fits in with the culture. The prophet Amos and also Hosea, they don't just attack them for their idolatry, they also attack them for what else? What came in chapter 5? Actually, here it came in the context of Ephraim himself. Yeah, I'd say it's mostly idolatry here, but Amos also attacks the north for its injustice to the poor. So not only are you committing idolatry, but morally, you're not caring about your oppressed brothers, and that is equally bad in God's eyes.
Is that the 480, end of 480, her rulers dearly love dishonor? I mean, that's the same idea.
It could be, but the word kalon there could also be a euphemism of a god. Like Bet El, they don't call Bet El, they call Bet Aven, the house of nothingness.
Right.
So there's this lightness as opposed to heaviness. In the Bible, the word for glory and respect is kavod. The opposite is kalon. It's disrespect, it's non-glory, and it's also, kavod is related to heavy, kal is light. And so a lot of these images are like that. So if God has glory, the non-God has this lightness, or this, you don't even want to give them the credit of naming them. And so instead, you're using words like kalon and words like nothingness, go to the house of nothingness, because you don't even want to acknowledge that that pagan god is a god.
Can you say a bit more about that? Because I don't think I understood the Beit Aven.
Okay, so, yes.
That.
So in the pantheon, in the, how would I say it? In the pagan family of gods, a pantheon, they have the one big creator god, El. His proper name is El. This is also the name of a word for God. And so every time you see El in the Bible, you can read it either way. His son then is Baal, who is the god of storms. So rain, storms, fertility, that all kind of goes together. And he has other children like all the gods do. So to call something Bet El, if you have a culture that is practicing foreign worship, is confusing. Is this El God or is it El the Canaanite God? You also have Baal as part of names. And so Baal, there would be certain towns named after Baal. Baal, and then it would have another geographic name with it for that town. So one way to kind of put El, the Canaanite god, in its place is by choosing to leave it out of the name. So instead of referring to Beit El as Beit El, you say Beit Aven. And what did they... Now, Aven also means kind of like nothingness or vanity, which, if you read Proverbs, is also associated to not just nothingness, but it's negative. It's like wicked nothingness. Things that don't really count, or wrong things. Sorry? I see some people don't realize what is going on. We don't normally have the Bible study meet here, so I don't think they've realized that they're not supposed to be opening that at the moment. Any other things that strike you?
Could you spell so that
Aven? Aven?
A-V-A-N.
In English, A-V-E-N. Uh-huh. In Hebrew, Aleph, Vav, Nun.
Okay. I do have a question about verse 7 of chapter 5.
Verse 7 of chapter 5, yes.
Now, a new moon shall devour them in their heritage. What's the reference to moon there?
Yeah. It's a very interesting little clip there. And let me preface by saying there's a lot of Hosea that people don't fully understand. It's like reading literature from a time that's not your own. Because you don't have all the other literature to compare it to, you have to try to guess. And so I think this is one of those passages that you would need more information to fully understand. But if you read the new moon as the new moon festival, soon the new moon festival will devour them and their fields.
My translation has now within the month the invaders will devour their lands. That's David Stern's.
Okay. So
now
within a month.
What does it say in Hebrew?
It says now he will eat them, the chodesh, the month. The month will eat them, their fields. So then you have to decide, is this the celebration of the month that's at the new moon mark for the month? Or is this in a month? It doesn't say be'od chodesh. It says ata yochlem chodesh. So the month itself is eating them. So it's just a very strange passage, and I'm sure there are several ways to understand it. Them and their fields. It does remind me, though, one of the forms of idolatry was to be sacrificing in fields. I don't know in the Northern Kingdom how much. I think of more of the high places. Like, have you been to Dan, Tel Dan?
Yes.
And you saw that big tree, the big Elah? And you thought, there's a high place there, and it's usually under a big, sprawling tree. And that, to me, is the picture of idolatry in the north. But there are references elsewhere to going into the fields and sacrificing to goat demons. And how and where that was practiced, were they both practiced? Was that more a southern thing? I don't know. But to eat the fields as a consequence for idolatry could possibly be a flip of that idea. If they're incorrectly sacrificing in the field to a wrong god, it's kind of like the punishment of that is that practice is going to backfire on them. That might be a way of understanding that verse.
Sharon, it says that, you have to sound the trumpet at Rosh Chodesh, the full moon and the new moon and so on. It's on whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, given that one of the things that Hosea is saying is that you're worshipping God wrongly,
mm-hmm.
it could be that in this context of the new moon, they're going after a whole bunch of other things. They're doing the right things. They're blowing the trumpet and all
right.
the rest of it. But they're not actually focusing on
God.
The Creator, who's the God who created
right.
this new month or whatever it happens to
right.
be. Or the festival of the moon month, which
right.
is the great feasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could very well be that. You're going through the motions, but doing
yeah.
it with
basically
the wrong heart. Now, again, remember, if Ephraim, who is the northern kingdom, if they're experiencing an economic boom, their gut reaction is like, great, we're blessed. Everything's going well for us. And so Hosea's whole point is, no, there's judgment coming, and actually all of that is going to be reversed at some point. You're going to receive, it's going to backfire at some point, and you're going to receive bad consequences for what you're doing, even though right now you may not feel it.
There's a question?
Yes.
Maybe a different reading. Just I realized that.
Yeah.
You can see the question being asked. So, maybe a different reading. So eating and drinking at that festival, the equivalent of what you might even drink in a month.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Consuming.
Consuming it all at once?
Consuming during that time of festival, everything, the equivalent of what you might consume in that month.
Right. But the metaphor is that the festival, or the month, is the one doing the consuming.
The month itself.
The month itself
okay,
is
on.
The subject of the verb.
Okay, hold on.
It's a curious passage.
Yes, exactly.
And also...
But would the exactly, that the month's worth would be consumed during the month. So in, during the time of the festival, or one day, a month is consumed.
The problem, though, it says the month consumes them. So who is the them? And it seems to be a metaphor, because a month can't consume, literally. So who is the month standing in for? So we have the idolatrous or incorrect worship during the monthly festival. That could be this metaphor of the month. Maybe a foreign god that they worshipped for the new moon. Maybe it's referencing that god, in which case it would be ironic. Like, you are producing children who are going astray, banim zarim, whether they're idolatrous children or just illegitimate children from your unions with these prostitutes, I don't know. And the chodesh is going to eat them.
And that's chodesh?
The chodesh, the month, is going to eat them. That's one option. Like, who the them are is not clear. Or is the them all of Israel? Because they rebelled. They is Israel. So, I don't know. I think verse 7 would need its whole own Bible study, as many verses of Hosea do. It's not an easy book to understand. But it's certainly worth thinking about and trying to come up with understandings of what he could be referring to. And I think the most helpful thing is to read it in the context of some type of practice within their idolatry that will backfire on them. So if they're sleeping with the temple prostitutes to secure fertility, it's exactly in that area that they're going to be targeted or wiped out, or there's going to be a reversal. And I think that's kind of Hosea's gist, if you will. Okay, it looks like we are out of time. So if you have more comments, feel free to talk afterwards. Otherwise, Shabbat Shalom, and we can head upstairs. There's a worship service starting in, 6 minutes. So, Shabbat Shalom.